You're listening to the Sound Girls podcast with Becky and Susan from Orlando, Florida. This episode features an interview with Tana Douglas, who is acknowledged as rock and roll's first female roadie. Her journey started in 1973 in Australia, and within a year, she was working for AC/DC, first doing backline then, and then front of house sound for the band. She moved to lighting, tour management, logistics, and has worked with some amazing names in the industry. Some of the big ones we'll talk about: Neil Diamond, The Who, Ozzy Osbourne, Whitesnake, Elton John, Iggy Pop, and just so many others that we would spend half the episode probably naming them all. So welcome. Thank you so much for doing our podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. And thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. I am super excited to talk to you. Rock and roll's first female roadie. That's your title, right? Like you own it now.
Well, that's where, I'm not sure where it came from. I mean, it never really occurred to me until probably the last 10 years or so. And then all of a sudden people started calling me and stuff and saying, you know, you're in this book, you know, and it's like, no, what do you mean? And it's like, you know, and then another person rang and said, you know, I don't know you, but I got your number from AC/DC's old bass player. And, you know, I want to, do a film script about your life. It's like, what are you talking about? Have you gone mad? No, what? Stop. So it was like, I kind of patted it off for a long time, you know, and then I kind of realized that there was a lot of stories out there, and some of them were accurate and some of them weren't. And Everyone loved to tell them except for me. So it was kind of like, you know, and I guess I planted the seed. I had no intention of ever acknowledging it or thinking about it even really at the time. I was too busy, and, you know, afterwards I didn't really think about it. But, you know, when there were talks of books and things like that coming up, it was like, you know what, I need to kind of shut this down. The only way I can shut it down is if I do it myself. So, I mean, I guess that's where it came from. You know, it's only been the last 10 or so years. I mean, obviously from day one there was no one else out there. So it was obvious, but it wasn't a focus. You know what I mean? It was just get on with it. if you work hard enough and fast enough, they might not notice. Just keep moving.
How old were you when you started in the industry, if you don't mind me asking?
I was 15 when I did my first, when I took part in my first production, which was a guy called Philippe Petit, who did a tightrope walk across the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Okay. And he's the guy who walked the Twin Towers as well. They made a movie about that called The Wire, or The Walk, I think it was called. And then straight after that, I started in music. So that wasn't music, but it was production. And then I started in music in Sydney. I was, you know, 15.
So. And that was with AC/DC?
No. Well, I was 16 with AC/DC. So I actually worked for another band in Sydney, and they took me to Melbourne, which is really the center of music at the time, and still kind of is really. And there was this huge production house there where someone who's, if anyone's toured Australia, they'll know Michael Gudinski. He's like a major promoter down there. And this was him just first getting started, and it was called Mushroom House. And it was a booking agency really at the time, and with some managers in, you know. So what would happen is, long before, you know, obviously any technology, we'd go in on Mondays, because Monday was usually the only day off, if at all. But everyone would get together and see what their band's doing and what's coming up, and, oh, that's cool, let's come to this show. Or if you're working, you know, yeah, you guys can come to ours. Or so it was kind of like networking before there was networking, you know.
And
that's where I got approached by one of the icons back then in the Australian music industry, a guy called Bill Joseph. And he was actually one of the members of AC/DC, but a silent sort of partner really. So he never gets any credit. No one ever talks about him, and I love him to death. And he's the one who offered me the job. So Bill, thank you up there. I love you.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. So, you know, he's the one who offered me the job when I was working for this other band, you know, and it was like, oh, you know, and he's like, well, you know, the band you're doing is doing okay. But what happens when they're not, you know? And it's like, well, what do you mean? I've never occurred to me, you know what I mean? It's like, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, what are you going to do for work if they stop, you know, getting as many shows as they're getting now? And it's like, none of this ever occurred to me. I just jumped in and started doing it, you know, and didn't occur to me that things would change and everything's different and it's all relevant to money and business, and none of that crossed my mind. It was all like, oh, yeah, I could do that. Let's go. This is exciting.
You know? Right.
So I was like a little puppy. Oh, good, what? But he actually gave me my first fright and said, you know, I do their bookings and their bookings are slowing down. So do you think one of these guys are going to hire you over another guy when they stop mm-hmm. work? And I went, ooh, and that was like a real cold, hard thought. It was like,
yeah,
you know, and it's like, I best not test that one just yet, you know, because I was so new. And it was like, but it occurred to me, I mean, it made it blatantly clear. It was like, wow. I mean, this, you know, because I mean, I'd started working with some of the A primo people in Australia, and I was really fortunate. They liked me and they took me under their wing and they taught me, you know, but still, it was there in the back of my mind. Are they going to hire me over someone they've known, liked, and taken under their wing for 10, 15 years as opposed to me for 8 months, 9 months, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So, and a girl, you know. So, yeah. You know, it was a cold, cold, hard fact. And so I actually left at the job, you know. I didn't know it was AC/DC at the time. It was just some band moving down from Sydney, you know. So, and then we all ended up in a house together, you know, which was good. So I had somewhere to live. It was like, oh, this is really good bonus.
So you lived with the band, you worked with the band. Like, how long until you realized, oh, these guys are huge, or they were becoming huge?
Nah, you could. I mean, the minute I walked into the house, you know, like when I said yes, then the other manager, Michael Browning, he got threw me in his car and said, come on then, you've got to meet him because they're heading back up to Sydney tomorrow. Okay. Jeez, you know. So off we went. And I swear to God, the minute you walked into that room, there was like six people in that room. And I sort of hung back and Mike went forward and they're all sort of chatting. And then they all sort of turned and looked at me. He must have said, you know, this is your roadie. You know? And there was something, there was this energy there and it was amazing. And it was weird because there was two totally different age demographics. It was like, there was a bunch like my age or just a little bit older. And then there were these older guys. And it was like, this is weird. What is it, the old guys or is it the young guys? I don't know who I'm talking to, you know. And it turned out that, you know, of course, Malcolm and Angus's older brother is George Young. And his partner, Harry Vander, were the Easy Beats. You know, that was the original, the 60s band that did really well in England and huge in Australia. And then they went on to produce all the major acts that came out of Australia for decades, you know. So yeah. Vander and Young were there. The manager was there. Bon was there. So that was the four old guys.
Wow.
In my mind. It was like, you look really old. And then there was Malcolm and Angus. And it was like, okay, they're cool. They're really young. Really short. They're so little. And, of course, it turned out I was always the biggest one in the band. It was like, oh, man, really? We sent our laundry out. And I stopped sending my jeans out. It was like, no, I'm not doing it. They're like, come on, they're going to wash all it. Nope.
Oh,
nope.
Because all the jeans had come back and then mine had come back. I mean, they were like 00 or something, you know what I mean? So it's not as though I was huge. I was just taller and you know, a normal size. But it's kind of weird for a girl. It's like, oh, man, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you could tell, yeah.
So how long were you in Australia doing all of that before you moved to the UK to work with Tasco?
Well, I actually, because I did AC/DC, you know, Backline started, then Front of House Sound, and then, you know, they were going to the studio to do another album, and it was like December, and then Christmas would be off, and then, you know, and it was like, you know, I don't want to stop working. So I kind of jumped ship, and you know, Malcolm spoke to me, actually. He said, you know what, we're going to change the production. We're going to go with a production house because we need to now, because the venues, you know, we need control, because we were doing like festival halls and stuff like that, which are, you know, 2,500, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 seaters, but we were reliant on whatever was there. And with the band of the volume that they had, we just couldn't, it wasn't working, you know? And the bottom line was I never had one lesson on how to do sound. I was asked to go and pick up a PA one day, and when I brought it back, they said, oh, by the way, we're gonna hire a new backline guy. And I thought, oh, great, some help at last. And they went, because you're going to do the front of house sound. I'm like, wait, what?
So you were a backline tech and went to go pick up the PA, and then they told you that was your job now was the front of house sound for AC/DC. Yeah.
Which is so AC/DC. That's how they are. It's like they decide something, they want something, they want it to happen now, and it does. Or forget it. You know what I mean? And it's like,
yeah.
Oh, and you know, their logic was, I knew them. I knew their sound. I knew what they wanted. I was always the one that they tell to go and sort someone out, or, you know, tell them we need this, tell them we need that. Because we didn't even have monitors on stage.
Really?
I was doing monitors and front of house with AC/DC. What a nightmare that. Can you imagine that? Without any training.
And the volume level.
Yeah, and no sound crew that I could even say, so what does this button do? It was just learning by flying by the seat of your pants, you know? I mean, it's funny because, you know, I still joke to this day, you know that sound AC/DC has? That's my fault. Because, you know, they've got that sound, that gritty sound still.
Uh-huh. It's very grunge.
I was mortified for years. I never told anyone I did front of house sound for them for years. I was so embarrassed. So I thought it was my fault. Who knew?
Who knew there was a whole generation of us that were listening to how awesome you were?
Well, who knew that they'd be like the third largest band in the world with that sound?
Right?
Like, oh God, don't tell anyone.
Just goes to show you, man, women can do anything.
It's funny. It's pretty funny. Yeah. No, and that's a true fact. That is a true fact.
And so, speaking of doing anything, you moved out of lighting world, or I mean, I'm sorry, out of sound world into lighting world.
Yes.
And so that's, you moved to the UK to work with Tasco.
I did eventually, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I did a bunch of international tours. I guess I got a little sidetracked. Sorry about that. I did a bunch of international tours quickly before I left. You know, in like 7 months, I did 10 major tours. You know, in 10 months, I did 7 major tours. So it was a lot of people I was meeting and a lot of knowledge and stuff. You know, and there was people like, you know, Patrick Stansfield, you know, who went on, you know, was a huge tour manager at the time, but went on to have just an immaculate, you know, work history and just an amazing person. You know, there was Chris Smythe Smoother from Delicate Sound. You know, he was on one of the tours. You know, there was Paul Newman who ran Tasco for ages and now he's at Clare Brothers. So there was a bunch of people that I met in that time who went on to actually play roles in my future, you know. But so when I moved to England, because I toured with Paul in Australia with Leo Sayer, I think it was, And so when I turned up in England, he's like, oh, hello, you know, but I did Quo first, you know. And what they did is they built their own lighting and sound rig. And so when I arrived over in the UK, the timing was kind of perfect. I had a rough probably 6 months, like really rough 6 months of like not having anywhere to live and not having any money and it was cold and it was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And of course my father's like, I'll send you only an air ticket, a one-way air ticket. He wouldn't even trust me with a round trip. He's like, I'll send you a one-way air ticket, but that's it. And I just wouldn't fail. It was like, you know what? No, I'm not doing it. No. So it was kind of scary and it was hard, but you know what? I think I made it harder for myself than I needed to because I wouldn't ask for help, you know, because I thought, I felt as a female anyway, as a girl, I felt a bit of a burden, which I probably shouldn't have, but also one that's unemployed, doesn't have any money, doesn't live in the country, and doesn't have a job. I thought, it's not really going to impress many people, you know.
and how old were you at the time?
I was 17 by then. Wow. And just about to turn 18. I mean, I turned 18 in England, but I had to get my dad to sign my passport before I left Australia because I wasn't old enough. So
that's, you know, that's was, true, Roadie.
Yeah. It was kind of rough, you know. So, like, you know, I mean, Wings had come through Australia just before we left. So, you know, like McCartney's, you know, personal assistant you know, Trevor, he gave me one of Paul's cars, which had custom license plates, MPL1. It was his first car ever for his company. And it was like a Vanden Pla, you know, which is kind of like a middle class Rolls Royce. And of course I had no driver's license, nowhere to park the damn thing. But it had a pull down it had pull down crystal trays. So I had somewhere to put my toothbrush. And I slept on the back seat. So it was like, oh, this is okay. You know, but then every now and then I'd have to move it somewhere, which was just terrifying. Oh God. So I don't know what happened. I went on tour and left it somewhere, so God knows where that ended up.
But so you lived in one of Paul McCartney's cars.
Yes. Yes, I did.
When you were 17.
For a while, yeah. Yeah.
For a while. Yeah,
not long. It was only probably a month. And it was on and off, you know, like I'd stay at someone's place for a bit, but I felt bad, you know, because I didn't have any money or anything. And it was like, oh, God, you know. And then I got a couple of gigs doing backline stuff. So that was okay, you know. So I did that for a bit, you know, whenever that would come along, I'd grab that. And then Quo said, you know, we're going to build our own lighting rig and sound system, and we're going to be touring for like the next 3-4 years nonstop, you know. Do you want to help us build it, you know, because the lighting designer, he didn't, so I'm not staying up 24/7 building soldering and welding and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it's like, I'll do it. You know? Then I didn't have to worry about anywhere to sleep, because we'd work and then we'd sleep on a flight case, then we'd get up and work again. So it's like, perfect. No one knows I'm homeless.
So you were building like one of the first big lighting rigs ever then, right?
Yeah. It was close to one of the first, you know. I think, you know, Pink Floyd already had, Brit Row already had stuff going, but mostly effect stuff, projection and stuff. The Who, you know, but the Who didn't own their stuff. They owned all their laser stuff and that, but, you know, but, yeah, the Quo sort of got the sound and lighting rig going, and they're just such a pleasure to work with. They're just such a great bunch of people, you know. So I landed somewhere safe and somewhere good, you know. So that was good, you know.
Did that kind of become like your family then?
It really did, you know. And I'm still in touch with a lot of them, you know, including band members, you know. So, you know, it's nice, you know. It really is.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it really is nice, you know. And then again, they were going off the road for 12 months after, you know, we did 3 years solid, boom. And so it was like, well, what do you want to do with the lighting rig? Why don't we take it somewhere and see if we can make some money out of it? Otherwise you're going to be paying storage for it, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. So, you know, we approached Tasco because they were only a sound company at the time. So what we did was we said, you know, they made this deal with them that, you know, bring the lights in, Tana will run the rig. She'll look after it. She knows it inside out. She built the goddamn thing, you know? And when it goes out, she'll go out with it, you know. So from that, I sort of became their head lighting person, you know, in the department, because we had to set up a department, you know. And then of course, we just kept adding more and more and more stuff, you know.
What shows did you do with that lighting rig? Do you remember?
A
ton, I'm sure.
You know, a ton of shows, yeah. We did a lot of we did Ozzy. We did his first two Blizzard of Oz tours. Those two did Whitesnake, David Coverdale, his second and third tours, The Police, Ghost in the Machine tours, tons of like one-off stuff, Elton John tour. And then it started like evolving that we needed more and more and more, and the system started getting actually broken up, you know, because at the time that system was built was just right on the cusp of when Avo Lights was starting. So, okay. And Avo Lights obviously came in and took over the entire industry, you know, which was, thank God, you know, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, so the whole
I was
concept,
just going to ask you, like, was it all like those old school Parkans with the, you know, ceramic housing for the lights and all that stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was mostly, I mean, any rock and roll gear. I mean, basically what happened was, from the 70s, you know, from the early 70s, you know, late 60s to early 70s was a lot of like projection effects and visual trippy stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
And as the audience changed, the music changed as the time changed. So everything was evolving together. So to me, it was a perfect time to be learning, you know, because no one else knew anything anyway. You know what I mean? And so I'd come through the early 70s, which was just a free for all. It was like, how can we make this work? I don't know, nail it to the wall. You know, there's no earth. Okay, well, here, nail it to the ground. You know, it's like whatever, you know. I mean, climb a light, you know, a street post to get electricity. You know, it's like, hey, there's no power. What are we doing? Well, why are we doing a show here? Well, there's that pole there. Let's tap into that. What? You know, I mean, ridiculous stuff. I mean, really dangerous stuff. But you learn from it as long as it doesn't kill you. And, you know, and so day-to-day problems all of a sudden become kind of insignificant, really, by comparison. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, that's all right. You know, you get electrocuted a few times. It's like, oh, damn, you know, and it's like, and not necessarily your own fault. You know what I mean? Thank God, not often. But,
you said that just nonchalant, like, you know, you get electrocuted a few times.
Yeah, well, it happens, you know. I mean, it's like you're on a balcony doing a follow spot and all of a sudden you put your hand on the rail and you get electrocuted. It's like, wait a minute, I didn't get electrocuted, like, when we set this up. What's going on, you know? And, of course, cleaners come along and knock the back off a porcelain. The wires all of a sudden magically come from inside an old Leco life to touch the one very railing in the whole building that you're touching. It's like, oh, thank you, dog. You know, so, I mean, stuff like that, that really isn't your fault. I mean, you can't go around paranoid looking everywhere for bare wires, you know. You may as well just touch something and see.
Oh, my God.
Sometimes, like, Susan's freaking out.
Woke her up. She's like, what? Touch something and see.
No, I mean, like, one of the biggest things that I do for my students is we talk about safety and we show them all of the things on how not to kill themselves. And our equipment is safe now. So,
by comparison. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I know. It's tricky stuff. There was not a lot of safety in place. None.
Did you originate some of those standards since you were the one building some of the first versions of it?
Well, I mean, did I personally? I mean, you make suggestions because you're physically out there doing it. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, if we do it this way, this is going to be a lot better. This is going to be a lot safer than because you want me to climb up this thing and it's swaying already. You know, it's like, no, that's not going to happen. What we need to do is this, you know what I mean? So you find ways, you know, I mean, that's how I started rigging, you know, I mean, and of course I never took any classes. I never trained how to be a rigger, but I was a ground rigger for a lot of people just purely because there was no one else to do it. So I'd always watch them and ask questions. And so, you know, when I went out on a tour that I felt that the person rigging was unsafe, it's just like, you know what? You're now lighting crew, I'll do the rigging, you know. So, and because I knew the venues, I'd done the venues for years. So it was like, I'd rather be up there myself and know it's safe, that I'm using, you know, the right wraps, the right beams and the right angles, you know, than having to keep sending someone back up going, what are you doing? This isn't right. We can't do this, you know. So, you know, that's how you learnt back then, you know. You just got in and did it, you know.
Yeah.
And hoped you were doing it better than the person before you.
Well, you've basically made your entire career jumps like in leaps and bounds from sound to lighting. I mean, what I would consider leaps and bounds, I guess. A lot of people in my generation kind of locked themselves into one specific thing. But as I'm reading through your bio, I'm seeing that you've done sound, lighting, touring. Have you done studio work as well? Some of that, maybe?
No, film lighting, but not, I don't think that's even in the bio, film lighting and stuff. But, not in studio, not studio audio, no.
But then the way into touring logistics and what do you do now? What's your main thing that you're doing now?
I stay at home and knit. No, I'm kidding. No, actually, well, I mean, I just completed a book that was meant to come out through HarperCollins in April, actually. I was supposed to be in Australia. I would have just been getting back now from promoting it. But that's been pushed back, obviously, because of the COVID thing. Mm-hmm. But you know, I do that. I do a lot of consultancy stuff. I do a lot of writing. I'm just starting doing blogs and really interested actually what I'm really interested in is VR and AR stuff. I think that's really, really, and I think right now with this climate, that's going to just take over everything, you know? Mm. But I think, you know, I think also to go back just a little bit, how you said that I jumped around a lot, I think people should do that, you know, because a lot of people start in the industry in a particular field and they find, and they're not necessarily good at it. And that doesn't mean they're not good. It just means it's probably not the right place for them. You know, so I tell people, don't be scared. Change. Try it. You know, if you, and especially if you don't like it, for God's sake, because a lot of people as well, you know, they're doing something and they just want to bitch and moan about it. It's like, what are you doing? Stop it. Go home. You know what I
mean? Go find something you like.
Go find something. I completely understand that. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Like I still do live sound occasionally, but I moved over to video production and I love video production.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone should, you know, try at least something else at some point.
Yeah.
Just not even as a career change, but just because it also gives you a broader perspective on how your other crewmates are doing stuff.
Yeah.
And why your job is what it is and how it interacts with all the other people on the crew. And I think that's a huge, huge thing that's important. And I think especially if you're a female, I think you need to know how, what part you're playing in the whole production. Don't focus on being a female. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm saying that you're there because you've been chosen to do the job.
Yeah.
So find out where you fit in there and what you do as part of the crew. Because I learned that very early, that my success came from being part of a crew, not being a woman.
Yeah.
You know?
I like that.
And whether that's unfortunate or not, but, I never expected any special consideration. God knows I never got any. And but you know, I mean, God, bathroom, please, hello, you know, anything, right? You know? It's like, but, you know, so it was rough and it was wild and it was a little woolly out there, you know what I mean? So, I mean, I think in this climate, you know, it's just, it would be so advantageous if people just took the time. And even if you, you know, I see a lot of people do shadowing and that sort of stuff now, which obviously wasn't an option back then. But, you know, shadow on a different department to your own.
Yeah.
Because you'll have a better understanding why someone's going, is that up yet? Can you get this off the stage? What's going, you know what I mean? You'll, and because that's the last thing you want to be is that person that's holding up the next crew from doing it. Part of the production, you know, and if you understand why they're saying what they're saying, then I think you'll have a better understanding on how to control your side of the production better, you know, and because that's what it's all about. You've got to be a strong member of a crew, and that means the whole crew, you know. You can't just be tight with your video pals, and you can't be just tight with your lighting people or just with your sound people, you know, because it's all so interlaced, you know.
Absolutely. And
it's heartbeat, you know, and you've got to keep that heartbeat going at a rapid pace. You know? So
the show must go on.
Yeah, you know, and it's important, you know, and plus, you know, you never know, you might find out that you actually really like it better, you know, and it's, and you know, I mean, when I jumped from different departments, it wasn't necessarily because I didn't like where I was. It was because I thought I could learn more in the next place that I went to.
And you did, right?
Yeah. And that's what it's always been. That's what it's always been about for me, is learning, you know, and I've always wanted to learn more, which I think is why I'm so excited with, you know, the whole virtual and alternate reality at this point, especially now, you know, because that's the only way we're going to be able to do shows.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Susan was actually just talking about this on another interview that we had a while back, that a lot of industries are shifting and doing kind of like a drive-in rave situation or a drive-in concert kind of situation right now. And I would have never in a million years thought about that being something that was huge, or, you know, doing concerts live online. I mean, that wasn't even reality 10, 12 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, the whole drive-in thing is a little beyond me, because I mean, who wants to listen to a concert through your car radio?
Yeah.
I don't.
No.
It's like,
that's not the point.
I mean, it's, I think I only ever went to a couple of drive-ins, not that old, but, and then that was like, they're on their last legs. Do you know what I mean? But it was like curiosity yeah. more than anything.
Yeah.
But I think, I swear, I thought people only ever went to drive-ins to make out and sneak their buddies in the trunk. You know what I mean? So I don't see how that transfers to a live concert. You know what I mean? I don't get it. Every time I see something online, you know, I think it's, was it Sweden that did it first?
Yes,
I think so. Yeah,
we are definitely not the first.
Yeah, and Spain's doing it now, and I don't get it. I don't get it. I mean, to me, you get such a better experience with a virtual ultra. You know, you put the band in a studio, you know, like a sound studio, a sound stage. You know, so everything's rigged beforehand that needs to be rigged. You know, the band's there. I mean, you can add with, you know, half a dozen projectors, you can add an entire audience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That isn't there. And you can watch it from anywhere you want to watch it. You want to watch it from the front row? Who's not going to want to watch every concert from the front row? You know, if they're smart, they'll do it so you can watch from the side of the stage. You know, charge different prices for different places.
Yeah,
in the audience. Yeah, you know,
I saw a Metallica movie in the movie theaters several years ago, and it felt like the best concert experience because no one else was in the theater. It was basically just us. It was loud, like louder than a movie, and I didn't have to stand around and get all sweaty. So, I mean, it was like a win-win in that situation.
Well, exactly. You put your headphones on. I mean, because that's how they're doing raves anyway. They put headphones on. You walk into a room, there's 1,000 people, and it's dead quiet. And they're all going nuts. It's like, what's happening?
Yeah.
and so you quickly grab a headset and then go, oh, okay, cool. All right, I'm in. Okay.
Yeah.
You become one of those silly looking people dancing around to nothing. You know? And they're all listening to different shows or different music or some of them are, you know what I mean? So it's kind of, you know, prices. But I mean, with the concert thing, you know, you do that, you put on your glasses, you put on your headphone. You know, what are you going to do? You know, you get a little carried away stage dive, you break your mum's coffee table. Who cares, you know? Parents are probably going to hate it, but hey, they've been hating it forever.
That's true.
At least they know where their kids are. Right? So, I mean, they could market it. Do you know where your kids are?
That's a great marketing.
Exactly. But, you know, but that to me is the only way around this because I just don't see, you know, bar venues, club venues. I mean, I until there's some sort of cure for this, some sort of, you know, either immunization or whatever. I don't know how this is going to work.
We're in Florida, and they don't apparently care if anyone lives or dies. So it's
– Well, you know, that
things are open here.
Like, yeah, that seems to be a general consensus. You know, me personally, I kind of care.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I'd like to actually make the launch of my book. Thank you very much. That would be good, you know.
And speaking of your book, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No.
Your book, do you have a date for when it's coming out yet? Or are we just kind of on hold?
It was meant to be April 20th. This year. So now, and through HarperCollins as a publisher, HarperCollins Australia is a publisher. Mm-hmm. And so they've penciled it in for April 2021 because they're hoping that everything will be all over by then and there'll still be enough of us left to care about reading. But
you're going back on tour after that, I guess, with the book tour?
book tour. But, you know, so... Yeah, so, I mean, you know, that's sort of penciled in. So what I did instead is I launched a website on that date. So it's you know, tanadouglas.com. There's a website there. I started doing blogs on it. There'll be at least monthly updates. There'll be, you know, stuff. And, you know, eventually it'll be interactive, you know. So,
cool.
You know, whether it's podcasts or whatever, but, you know, I'm taking it through the levels. I'm just doing it. One step at a time, you know, I've got a year to play with it. So, you know, we're adding different content all the time, you know, like there's a playlist that goes with the book. So the playlist is up on the website, you know, so even though you can't read the book, you can get an idea of what's going on through the playlist. You know what I mean? So,
I,
you know,
I, stuff, down, I downloaded the playlist to my Spotify last night and I was jamming out to it. And I was
like,
you did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very cool.
That was great playlist, by the way. I might use it for walk-in music or something.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's not necessarily my favorite songs, but it's either the name of a chapter of the book or it relates to something that happened in one of the chapters, you know, so, and it's kind of in the order, you know, that the book runs. So, you know, it gives you some sort of idea of what's going on. You know, starting with, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of this place. There's a clue. Look out, she's off.
I loved it. It was a good trip down memory lane, just listening to, you know, the Spotify playlist there.
Oh, good.
And,
good.
And I thought, man, I can't wait to read your book. I'm super excited about it. So I already went on Amazon and set up an alert to let me know when it's coming.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you so much.
So anybody else can do that. You can get it downloaded as soon as it happens or buy it.
You know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's, it's through HarperCollins and it's called Loud.
I love it.
Yes.
So I have a question that we're asking everybody. Do you have a roadie nickname?
It depends who it was. T was the go-to because so many people got Tana wrong for some reason. It's like, you know, it was Tanya, and I still get Tanya and stuff like that from people I've known for like 40 years. It's just like, you know, what's the point? What's the point? Yes, what do you want, darling? You know, so there was T. Patrick Stansfield nicknamed me Tenacious T.
Nice.
Long before Tenacious D, I might add.
Right.
And who else? Oh, the Shoko guys, they nicknamed me Ace, which I thought was very cool, Texan thing.
I like that.
Yeah. And what else was there? Oh, another one was, Tana Turak, which is like an expensive neighbourhood in Melbourne, Australia. So Tana Turak. Not quite sure why that came around, but it was kind of funny. But, I mean, you know, they've all been pretty good. I think there was one briefly which was a sign of the times where I can't even remember what crew it was, but some international crew came in, and when they saw it, like we'd all walked onto the stage and the trucks were just opening the gate, you know, we're just opening the back doors of the trucks. And so we're getting introduced and some guy just looked at me and said, useless.
Wow.
He called me useless, I know. But by the end of it, he called me Sprite. So that was kind of cool. So
it was like,
yeah, it only took a day. So, and I made him apologize.
Good.
Yes.
I know. Yeah, so you want me to get that case? What do you say? This case here, you need it over there? Yeah, I get that bit. What do you say? So, you know, and that's, you know, that to me, humor's a lot of it, you know, a lot to do with it, you know, being a female working in the industry, you know, you've got to have thick skin and you've got to have a sense of humor. And, you know, if you give as good as you get humor wise, you know, you'll win. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, I was a little caustic mouth sometimes.
Aren't we all?
But, you know, I mean, that's how it is. You know, I mean, that's my personality anyway. I'm pretty direct and to the point, you know, so I wasn't going to change it for anyone, you know. So, but, you know, I mean, I just think, you know, you've got to get outside of yourself, forget about yourself sort of thing and think about what's going on around you and how you're a part of that, you know. And if it means cracking it, if it means standing up yourself and cracking a joke, you know, it's the way to go. Yeah.
Any other advice you have for us as we're wrapping up here?
Yeah. If I was waiting for tours to start again, I would be learning as much as I could in every different field. Again, going back to diversification. Mm-hmm. You need to do it now more so than any other time in this industry. You need to diversify right now. You don't have to just drop what you're doing or what you were doing, should I say, but you're going to have to diversify and keep up to date. All these companies are offering training courses for free. Jump on it. Take it. Don't drop out. See it through. What, you got something else to do? Come on. You know, so it's like I think it's really, really important that you do that or you're going to get left behind because this industry is going to it's going to be brutal. It's going to be severely brutal. And whoever survives in this industry is still going to get cut. You know, so because I don't care how many tours they say are going to want to go out at the same time, it's going to be different.
Yeah.
It's going to be different. I don't think there's going to be touring rigs like there was. That's gone. And I think a lot of the promoters are going to have the say on how budgets are spent. And that means cutting crews. You know, and I think it means that a lot of bands are going to walk into venues when this time, if this time comes back, and the rigs are all going to be up there. I mean, it happens now with, you know, the smaller mid-sized venues anyway. But I think it's going to actually go way beyond that, you know, and where, you know, where they take 100 crew, it's just not going to happen, you know. I mean, I think people are going to be down to a handful of people, if they're lucky, you know, and systems aren't going to tour. It's almost like a throwback to the 70s where you just turn up at a show and there'd be whatever was there you used, you know, and that's how it was, you know, and I think it's going to be like that for a long time. So diversify, do whatever you can to protect yourself because you're going to need it. That's what I suggest, you know, and don't put a time frame on this. Don't put a time frame on this. You're going to drive yourself insane and you're going to get really, really depressed. So what you do is just make the most of every single day that you've got here and learn something. Learn something, reach out to people, look after each other. That's what you need to do. And build friendships, build bonds. You can do it online. You really can do it online. And you can network. Network yourself silly. You know what I mean? Don't drive people mad, but you know what I mean? Network where it's viable to network because you don't want to be wasting other people's time either. You know what I mean? Because that will go against you. But seriously, learn as much as you can and diversify as much as you can because it's going to be a whole different road out there. That's the best advice I can give.
That is great advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tana.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to the Sound Girls podcast today. Join us next week when we'll talk to another amazing sound human. Don't forget, the scholarships are still open. Leslie Ann Jones Scholarship in honor of Ethel Gabriel. The Sound Girls has a scholarship also, and then the Ethel Gabriel scholarships. All three of those Sound Girls scholarships, all three scholarships are open on soundgirls.org. So make sure that you fill those out and get them in before the deadline, which is July 30th at midnight. Have an amazing Sound Week, Sound Humans. That's a new one. Amazing Sound Week.